The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Variety Channel. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericavariety.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
When you turn on the evening news, do you see what you want to see or what you need to see? Welcome to Bread for the Journey, ordinary people doing extraordinary deeds with your host, Mariana Cacciatore. It seems like more often than not, the good news and people that are making it are buried into a two-minute feature piece near the end of the report. What about giving these people and this kind of news a full hour every week? Now, here's your host, Mariana Cacciatore.
Hello and welcome to our show today. I've got Dr. Margaret Blaustein with us to talk about children and their caregivers, particularly kids who've experienced some kind of trauma, be it a one-time experience or chronic trauma, and the people who care for them. We'll be talking about what the adults in such a child's life can do to help them cope in the moment and for the long run. And we'll be talking about what those adults can do to take care of themselves as well. Last week, I did a show with Diane Marshall about the innovative judicial program called Collaborative Courts, in which drug-addicted adults who are in serious trouble with the law are being given a rare last-chance opportunity to turn their life around. Everyone in the judicial system, from the judge to the prosecutor, the district attorney, parole officer, arresting officer, they all work in collaboration to design, with the adult who's been arrested, a 2+ year program to help them stay clean and become healthy citizens, parents, and employees. Nearly every one of the people served by collaborative courts was a traumatized child. Today, we're going to talk about work being done with children as close to the time of the trauma as possible. It's a valuable, very valuable intervention program designed to reduce the chances of kids growing up and creating the kinds of lives that are at the center of collaborative courts. But before we begin, I'd like to say a few words about Bread for the Journey. We're a nonprofit organization that helps small clusters of volunteers in 26 cities give micro-grants to people who are doing things that make their community and our world a better place to live. We're basically working in the field of generosity. And the question I always feel that we're working with is, how can we all become people who are generous of spirit? Our vision statement at Bread for the Journey is to nurture the seed of generosity in every human heart. And that's why that question is always sent at the top of my thinking. How can we become people who are generous of spirit? And what I know about Dr. Margaret Blaustein, our guest today, is that she's working on behalf of caregivers, a segment of our population who have to draw on their own wellspring of generosity every single day to work well with a child, and particularly a child who's been traumatized. And she herself is a person, Margaret, is a person who's incredibly generous of spirit. We've been working together all week long getting ready for this show, and it's just been an absolute delight. We're going to learn a lot today from this interview, whether we're working with traumatized kids or kids who have not been burdened with such challenges. You know, everyone gets upset. Whether you're learning how to help navigate your life with kids in a way that's helpful, welcomed, and kind, that's really what we're trying to do today. Learn how to be with kids, no matter what's going on, in a way that's helpful, welcomed, and kind. So let me begin with an introduction of Dr. Margaret Blaustein. She's the Director of Training and Education at the Trauma Center at Justice Resource Institute in Brookline, Massachusetts. She's a practicing clinical psychologist who specializes in the assessment and treatment of complex childhood trauma. She's co-developer of the ARC, A-R-C, treatment framework, which we'll be talking about today, and is co-author of the text Treating Traumatic Stress in Children and Adolescents, published by Guilford Press. She's provided extensive training to clinicians, educators, professionals, and consumers regarding the impact of and intervention for childhood onset trauma. Dr. Blaustein is also involved in research on the impact of trauma on both children and adults. Welcome, Dr. Blaustein.
Thank you so much. It's really a pleasure to be here today.
I'm glad you are. In our interview today, we're going to be talking about kids and adults in their lives, because much of the work you've done with the creation of the ARC treatment framework has been to find a way to help adults help the kids. Mm-hmm. So let's begin our interview by telling our audience who these kids are and who the caregivers are.
Sure. So, you know, I think it's really important to just start with acknowledging that, unfortunately, trauma and adversity are not rare experiences, that a really overwhelming number of children in this country are exposed to adversity, to chronic stress in some way, on some level, at some point during their childhood. We know that, you know, up to 3 million kids are referred for child welfare services every year. There's 500,000 children in out-of-home care in a given year, that as many as 1 in 5 children in this country live in chronic poverty or lives in a home where there's not enough food to eat on a daily basis, where the housing conditions are inadequate. So adversity is unfortunately a really all too common experience of childhood in this country, and stress leads to an organized response around stress. And so our framework is really designed for kids who've experienced layer upon layer of adversity in their lives and who've really organized their lives around surviving and responding to that adversity.
Mm-hmm. So more for kids who have chronic trauma than kids who have had a one-time experience?
Yeah, really, that's who we have targeted, because there are some very good treatment approaches to work with children who've had more acute incidents, who have had more intact childhood experiences and then experience an overwhelming stressor, a significant incident of violence or a natural disaster. When trauma affects kids in layers in a more chronic way, often within the family system, one of the challenges is that it doesn't just affect the child, it affects the larger family, it can affect the community. And while certainly that happens with any type of adversity, with chronic adversity, we really need to think about not just how to work with a child, but how to really establish a safe system around them. And that's something that we felt hadn't been paid attention to quite as much when we started our work.
So that brings us to the question of who are the caregivers?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a really interesting question, because one of the things that we struggled with, and I just want to acknowledge Christine Kinnenberg, who's the co-developer of the ARC treatment framework and co-author of the book that you referenced earlier, and she's been my partner and collaborator in this effort for quite a long time now. One of the things that we struggled with, as so many people who practice clinically in this field do, is that we work with kids in so many different kinds of family and caregiving systems, everything from kids who are still in intact biological homes to kids in foster care, kids who've been in 15, 20 placements by the time we get to know them, kids who are now living with other relatives, working with kids in residential programs, or sometimes working in systems where they really have little access to a parent. And so the system itself is the caregiver. And we really think about the number of adults who are influential in children's lives, and the list can get pretty long when kids in particular have experienced adversity, because those kids are so often involved with multiple child-serving systems. And so we really think of caregivers as the range of adults who come into the lives of kids, whether that be parents or teachers or, you know, the receptionist in an office who's the first face a child sees when they walk in a door, to staff in a milieu program, in a residential program, to a doctor's office. There are a lot of adults who have an impact on kids and on their lives, and all of them are potential caregivers.
Got it. And the story I read that made me aware of your work as part of the story was the bus driver. Saying, uh-huh. And that's the first person that a child sees after they've left a home where there might have been, you know, a difficult morning.
Mm-hmm. So absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. And, you know, we sometimes don't think about how impactful different individuals can be, but that transition from home to school, it's hard for a lot of kids, let alone a kid who really struggles with transition or who struggles with shifting relationships or shifting from one activity to another. And a lot of people can have an impact on whether a kid's day is successful or not.
Right. So a program that even trains the bus drivers or has the potential to train the bus.
That's pretty amazing.
I know. I was just touched. So that brings us to this, you know, ARC treatment framework. I want to first say congratulations on having it be the foundation for this Head Start Trauma Smart program that's uh-huh. being used in hundreds of Head Start programs throughout the country. So kudos to you for doing this and for getting that kind of exposure mm-hmm. for the benefits of your program. Uh-huh. So why don't we tell our audience, what is the ARC treatment framework?
So ARC stands for Attachment, Self-Regulation, and Competency, and it's an intervention approach that was designed to meet the needs of children, families, and systems who've been exposed, as I said, to chronic trauma or adversity. And it really had its origins about a decade ago when we and our agency were doing a fair amount of work trying to bring trauma-informed services to community-based programs. We had a grant from the National Child Traumatic Stress Network, which is a wonderful federally funded initiative that supports trauma-focused work for children across the country. And we were early in our own process, and we're doing a lot of work going into schools and homeless shelters and domestic violence programs and trying to bring in clinical intervention approaches into very stressed systems, and found that the work often really fell apart because the systems themselves were so stressed and so overwhelmed themselves, and they were operating in ways that were not really trauma-informed. And we really took a step back and thought, what does it mean to do trauma treatment? What does it mean to support kids and families who've experienced trauma, who've experienced adversity? And in what way does that go beyond individual clinical intervention? And it led us towards really trying to identify core targets of intervention that we felt translated across different kinds of systems. And where it came to was really thinking about these three broad domains that we're trying to support, that at its simplest, we're trying to support a safe caregiving system. And what that means is a caregiving system, again, whether that be parents or teachers or providers who are themselves well-regulated, who have a good support system, who feel safe in the environment in which they work, and who are able, in turn, to be supportive in safe and consistent ways to the kids in their care. So starting at that attachment level, and then really thinking about how to support regulation in kids, because so many kids impacted by trauma struggle with just chronic dysregulation of arousal. They don't know what's happening in their bodies. They don't know how to manage it. They've been exposed to such chronic stress that their baseline level of arousal and stress is so high, and it shows up in their behaviors and their reactions and relationships and their ability to focus and get things done. And so we want to target those skills that help them sort of live in their bodies and manage their experience in their worlds. And then we really want to target normative developmental competencies, which for trauma-exposed kids often get sacrificed in service of survival. So if you're facing stress and danger and violence on a daily basis, your brain's going to develop a lot more in line with dealing with that experience than learning how to be patient and how to get along with other kids and how to get a really good sense of what you like and what you don't like. And so we want to focus on really getting kids back on that path of resilient development and supporting the range of developmental competencies that allow for that over time.
Mm-hmm. And so that's what the framework is. What are those? Go ahead. I'm sorry.
I was just saying that's what the framework is.
Thank you. It's mm-hmm. very helpful. So what are some of the symptoms of traumatic stress? If somebody's working with a kid, how do they know they're dealing? You know, you might be, you know, it might be the bus driver. It might be.
Yeah.
How do you know?
It's a great question. I hear you saying, how do you know? And the truth is you don't. And one of the things that we really like to emphasize for systems we work with, particularly for systems that are not specifically designed for children who have experienced trauma. So, for instance, if you're in a mental health system, kids are coming to you. They're referred for specific challenges or issues they're dealing with. Sometimes they are referred because we know their history. In a school, you don't know. You don't know necessarily which kids have been exposed to trauma and which haven't. And I think one of the errors we make sometimes is thinking in terms just of the individual child. Of course, we want to think of the individual child. But in any given system in which you have, let's say, 100 kids, even in the most resourced community, you need to assume that 30 of those kids at least have been exposed to some sort of adversity in their childhoods. I mean, the numbers really aren't rare. And so I just want to start with that foundation. Having said that, certainly as kids are impacted by trauma, and especially when they're impacted by multiple layers, there are things that we start to see. And I want to separate out a little bit a more acute post-traumatic reaction from a more chronic developmental adaptation around trauma. And, you know, stepping away from diagnosis, we like in the mental health world to sit with diagnosis, but the truth is one of the challenges of trauma-impacted kids is they often don't fall neatly into any single diagnostic presentation. And, you know, there's some debate in our world as to whether we yet have a adequate diagnosis to capture what our kids struggle with, because it is very developmental over time. We see is a core feature a real, we call it a dysregulation of experience, meaning that in typical development, kids learn how to, you know, in age-appropriate ways, calm themselves down when they're upset, how to manage sadness and anger and frustration and their different feelings, how to manage just arousal and energy in their bodies in general, how to express themselves and talk to people. And when kids are exposed to really overwhelming experience over and over again, one of the things it does is it can lead to chronic shifts on just a physiological, biological level in kids' bodies. And then compounding that is the fact that many of the kids we work with have experienced that distress in their homes. And so they haven't gotten, at times, really consistent input from their primary caregivers, their parents, their grandparents, whoever it is taking care of them, that's helped them then learn and internalize those skills, often because the parents or grandparents are so overwhelmed themselves. So we have sort of a dual whammy happening developmentally. We see kids who struggle with relationships, because if you've been hurt in relationship, it makes sense to not quite trust people and to not have developed the skills to navigate those relationships successfully. You know, basically kids have to approach the world with an assumption that other people are dangerous, that they're going to hurt them, that they can't be trusted, and they play that out in relationships over time. We see kids who struggle with really quick danger responses. I always sort of break it down. I like to say at its simplest, our kids get really good at what they need to survive and not so much at everything else.
Right.
them survive is assuming that you're dangerous, being really ready to respond at any given time, at keeping their arousal level really high so they're ready to go, at getting their needs met, often in a way that's not so pleasant. They're really good at that stuff. And then the rest of the developmental skill set is compromised because it's not where the energy is going.
Got it. We've got to take a break, but we're just getting started. So our listening audience, stay with us. We'll be back in just a moment.
Family caregivers face some tough challenges every day in caring for a partner, parent, child, sibling, friend, neighbor, or even coworker. You are there to provide the care that these people need after everyone else has gone home. Family Caregivers Unite with Dr. Gordon Atherley will provide you with a social networking experience. You'll hear from experts and others who are experiencing the same things, and together you will promote a common cause. Tune in to Family Caregivers Unite live every Tuesday at 1 p.m. Eastern, 10 a.m. Pacific on Voice America Variety. Museums are great places to work and wonderful places to visit, but are they essential? How can we improve our museum practice so that museums remain vital and essential players in society? Listen for Museum Life with host Carol Bossert, where each week we'll discuss timely and topical issues of concern to the museum community. Museum Life can be heard live every Friday morning at 10 a.m. Eastern Time, 7 a.m. Pacific Time on the Voice America Variety Channel.
Are you a single parent trying to create the balance between home life and work life? You may be running a successful business, but how are your relationships with your family and children? If you're one of the thousands of people trying to juggle it all, tune in to Straight Up with Chris, real talk on business and parenthood, hosted by Chris Efesiou. Chris is the portrait of the success story. Coming to the U.S. with no language skills, founding and growing several businesses, while raising his daughter from age 7 to adulthood as a single dad. Listen every Thursday at 6 p.m. Eastern, 3 p.m. Pacific on Voice America Variety.
You are tuned in to Bread for the Journey, ordinary people doing extraordinary deeds with your host, Mariana Cacciatore. If you have a question or comment about the program or have an idea for a person you would like featured on a future program, please send an email to bfjradio@gmail.com. That's bfjradio@gmail.com. And now, back to Bread for the Journey.
Welcome back, and we're here talking with Dr. Margaret Blaustein about kids in trauma and their caregivers. So at the end of the last segment, what you were really talking about was this way that kids become hypervigilant.
Uh-huh.
Right. And really in, I don't have a big question about this. It's more an awareness that, you know, at the beginning of the show, I was talking about last week's show. And I'm guessing that that hypervigilance is really hard on a person's nervous system, internal nervous system. And so over years, if they don't learn how to manage that, that's why they begin to turn to drugs, maybe to self-medicate and to calm themselves down, or they become sort of perhaps even addicted to that hyper arousal and they like it, and so they're choosing, you know, upper kind of drugs to keep it going. Yes?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, one of the things that we think about a lot is how the behaviors that people engage in make sense, that as human beings, we do what we do for a reason, that most of our behaviors are functional, they serve some purpose for us. And for individuals who've experienced trauma who are living in really dysregulated bodies, at a certain point, that stops feeling tolerable. And you do something to help you cope with and manage that experience. And drugs are one of the not atypical methods that people turn to. I always say I find it ironic that what leads to referral for treatment for so many of our clients are the coping strategies that they use to manage their internal experience.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So before we begin going on and talking about the adults in a child's life, you know, the caregivers,
uh-huh.
I'd like to know what happens to a child when they get triggered.
Uh-huh.
What does being triggered look like?
Sure. So let's just define first what triggering is. And, people can define it in varying ways, but essentially what we think about it is a trigger is a cue. It's a sign. It's some signal in the environment that tells a child that they're in danger. And often it's not true danger, it's the perception of danger. So take a straightforward example. If someone's been, for instance, in a fire, and that experience of fire is associated with a lot of different sensory inputs that signaled a pretty overwhelming, dangerous experience, afterwards, there are going to be sensory inputs associated with that experience that kick up a feeling of fear, arousal, and potential danger, like the smell of smoke, for instance. Mm-hmm. Well, the same thing is true for children who experience more chronic adversity, except that the number of cues that can signal potential danger is huge. So if you're a child who's lived, for instance, in a really chaotic home with a, let's say, substance abusing parent who is sometimes present and sometimes absent and sometimes violent and sometimes not, and who has all sorts of different facial expressions, that child may be triggered by their danger response, may be really geared to go off from any kind of sudden change, any unpredictability, certain sounds, certain facial expressions, someone moving too quickly, coming too close to them. I mean, there's a huge number of things that tell that child's brain that they're in danger. And once these paths are laid down in the brain, they stick pretty hard, right? They're pretty indelible. So once that happens, once the child's brain perceives and labels something as dangerous, the response is pretty instantaneous, and we go into self-protection mode. And our danger system is designed to be very efficient, and it's kept us alive over the course of evolution. We survive for a reason. And so certain sequences of things happen once that danger signal goes off. Our higher cognitive functions shut down. They're not considered essential at the time of danger, because you don't want to be thinking when you're in danger. You want to be acting. Arousal surges through our body so that we have the energy we need to deal with whatever the danger is. We react very quickly. We can get sort of tunnel vision around what we're doing, what we're focusing on. We engage in defensive maneuvers. We can go into a fight mode, which is sort of an aggression to protect ourselves. We can try to get away. That's the flight. There's a freeze response, which is a very high arousal, stilling and watching. That's a vigilance response. And there's a sort of submit, a collapse response, where the child tries to protect themselves. So all of this can happen in a snap when a child perceives that something is dangerous. And often, and what's so complicated about this, is that kids often don't realize what's happening. It's not that there's this conscious, hey, you looked at me funny, and that reminds me of past experiences, and that feels dangerous to me, and so now I'm going to go into self-protection. It's, I was feeling good a second ago, and now I hate everyone, and I'm scared, and I don't know why.
Right.
And I'm adding language on where often language doesn't exist. So it's very confusing. And then that's for the child, and then add on for the caregiver, who has no idea what just happened or why we were doing so well, and suddenly now this child is escalating or throwing a tantrum or throwing something across the room.
Right. So this is a perfect segue for us to begin to talk about the caregiver.
Mm-hmm.
What, in that moment when something has happened, what can a caregiver do to calm the situation down?
Yeah, it's so hard, because this is where I always wish there was like that one response where I could say, here's what you do every time. And there just isn't, right? And it would make it so much easier. We approach it from a few different lenses. And the frame we really try to push is start with curiosity, observe. The lens we want adults to use is to get curious about behaviors, so that when that kid escalates, has a sudden tantrum out of nowhere, shuts down, disappears, runs out of the room, instead of reacting to the behavior, we want to get curious about why the behavior is happening. Because over time, we want to start to get in front of it.
Mm-hmm.
We want to manage our own emotions, and that's a huge foundation of how we respond, because what often happens is the child escalates and then the adult escalates along with the child, and that's just natural. Regulation with kids is co-regulation. They get upset, we get upset, we feel it in our bodies. And it's a lot less effective to intervene with a child who is upset if we are also now ourselves shouting and reactive and angry and hurt and upset and everything else. And you know, it's easy to say, watch your own emotional experience. It's the single hardest thing to do.
Right. I remember once being in a work situation, as a staff meeting, where somebody got angry with me, I got angry with her, and we just developed into a war of words, which was just, it was an unusual situation. I mean, it had never happened before, but I was in it and she was in it, and we couldn't find our way out. And luckily, one of the people who was working with us was a therapist. And so she just intervened at one point, and she called a 60-second silent breathing break.
Mm-hmm. That's
and
great.
It was amazing what happened. I mean, actually, before the 60 seconds was up, and I really was focusing on my breath. At that point in my life, I'd been a meditator, you know, maybe for 7 years. So I just really used my breath in that time. And within really 30 seconds, 40 seconds, I was in a completely different place. And when we resumed our conversation, we got through it without screaming at each other.
Yeah, and that's it's a great example of it. We talk with people about how do you step outside of the cycle, because what happens is that cycle builds. Anyone, you know, we can all think of times in our lives when we get pulled in by emotion. Parenting in the best of circumstances is emotionally arousing. It pushes our buttons and it gets us frustrated. And, you know, I'm a parent and I know that when I'm calm, I'm a much different parent than when I'm frustrated or when I'm really tired. Right? Or really upset with something that's happening outside of the home and it's pulling in and infiltrating. And multiply that, you know, by many fold when you deal with a child who has really extreme level and unpredictable emotions that don't make sense to you, that feel overwhelming, that feel like they're targeting you personally, you know, for many different reasons. So it really starts with this foundational frame of we need to take care of caregivers. And doing that involves a lot of different things. And so you gave an example where taking a pause and stepping back and breathing worked, and that works in some situations. And then there's other situations where it's really hard to do. And so we really want to work with adults to be aware of their own emotional experience. How do you know when you're doing okay, when you're having a hard time? What are the clues that you get? How do you manage different types of situations? How can you be aware of what your push buttons are? We all have them. We all have things that are going to get to us more than other things. How can you sort of prep yourself going into situations that you know are challenging, and how do you catch yourself once you're in them? So it can be complicated, but it can also be about just making it a priority and really holding within a family, within a system, that the adult's awareness of their own reactions matters. And it matters because it feeds into the child's reaction. So that's a really important starting point. Thinking about that modulation is what we call it, that modulation, that affect management process. So we have these two sort of halves of the puzzle, which is we call it the observe, the modulate, the get curious, the notice, and regulate, and then think in terms of timing. So we want to really support the regulation of the child. Mistake we make as adults is we jump in and we try to do stuff. We try to talk and we try to fix and we try to problem solve and we set limits and we intervene in behaviors and we step in when sometimes we should step back and we step back sometimes when we should step in. And part of what that can do for a child who's already in a dysregulated state, who already feels in danger, is that it can escalate things further. And if we do a lot of talking, that part of the brain is often is just, it's not online in that moment. So we're really trying to look at how we can increase the felt sense of safety for everyone in that moment, and then sort of take that symbolic breath, step back once everything is leveled and more stable, make a decision about where to go next, whether that is problem solving or limit setting sometimes, or supporting, processing, talking through what happened, thinking about how to anticipate the next situation. And what is going to support the getting back to baseline is different for every kid. And that's where the work comes in, is that we have to work on our attunement, on how to know how to meet the needs of individual kids, how to read what is underneath the behavior, since it's called attunement. So attunement is really about reading those messages that kids are sending.
Right. So a situation has escalated. The caregiver's job is to first sort of pause, try to keep themselves to observe, but instead of stepping in, take a step back, pay a little bit of attention, and perhaps there was in some of the stuff that I read of your material, reflection was used at that point. Can you talk about what reflection is?
Sure. So, you know, a big part of how kids learn their own experience is that it gets mirrored to them. And the same is true for all of us. If you're really upset, you've had a hard day, something that can feel really nice is someone says to you, man, you look so frustrated. It looks like you are just so beat, right? And it's someone who sees us and who sees our experience. And that's reflection. That's mirroring, right? Children really need mirroring. They really, that's how, we talk about how the earliest lens that a child has for themselves is the mirrored reflective lens of their caregiver. Kids learn just normatively. Infants learn how to discriminate their own emotions, their own body states, because other people respond to them and put language to them over time and meet those needs in different ways. And so when a child is very frustrated, especially a young child who struggles with language themselves and struggles with awareness, having someone, the child throws something across the room, and instead of the first response being stop that, having someone say, oh my gosh, you just got so mad. It's just a different way to respond to a child. Now, it doesn't mean that we say go ahead and throw things across the room, right?
Right.
I mean, you know, so when you just said now the first thing we do is take the step back, I would sort of add to that, safety is always our most prominent concern. We establish safety. We make sure that kids are safe in their bodies. We make sure that we're safe in our bodies. We want our systems to be safe. But to do that, to get to safety, doesn't always mean intervening in a way that is very powerful and controlling.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So it could be as simple as reflecting, you look really mad, or is that...
Yeah, so that's a starting point often, is to do a very simple reflection. I see you're so mad, you're so frustrated right now, or gosh, what I just said felt not good to you. You know, I can see that what I just said felt bad. And you keep it really simple, because if a kid's really escalated, they're really highly aroused, they're not taking in a lot of what you're saying. So we're really just trying to see and name and respond. Sometimes we're taking a guess. It looks like you really need, it looks like you really need some space right now. Now, some of this we can do in the moment, and some of what we really want people to do is learn to read kids over time. So you may have kid A who, when they escalate like that, what they really need is someone to sit next to them and put their arm around them. Right, I'm thinking of young kids now, because I know that's what precipitated our conversation today. And another kid, you do that, and that's going to escalate their arousal so much that they're going to get really much more upset. Because in that moment of being triggered and of feeling in danger, having close physical contact actually makes them feel less safe. And so some of this is experimentation over time, in the same way that every parent learns their own child. And you learn, for me, I have a son and a daughter, and my son and daughter are two very different people. And they there are different types of responses that help in different situations, and that's true in all of our relationships.
Got it. We've got to take another break, and when we come back, we're going to talk a little bit about affect.
Okay.
So, to our listening audience, stay with us. We'll be right back.
Are you a single parent trying to create the balance between home life and work life? You may be running a successful business, but how are your relationships with your family and children? If you're one of the thousands of people trying to juggle it all, tune in to Straight Up with Chris, real talk on business and parenthood, hosted by Chris Efesiou. Chris is the portrait of the success story. Coming to the U.S. with no language skills, founding and growing several businesses while raising his daughter from age 7 to adulthood as a single dad. Listen every Thursday at 6 p.m. Eastern, 3 p.m. Pacific on Voice America Variety. Listen for Trust Across America every week on the Voice America Variety Channel. Tune in as the show is often hosted by national experts in the fields of leadership, teamwork, management, corporate responsibility, accounting, governance, finance, organizational behavior, and sustainability, as well as companies that are applying strategies that are enabling them to be more trustworthy. Your hosts are trusted professionals with years of experience in applying strategies with today's leading organizations. Trust Across America is heard Wednesdays at noon Eastern, 9 a.m. Pacific on Voice America Variety. Ready to chat about your favorite soap operas? The Daytime Discussion is here with Dan J. Kroll and Soap Central Live. For the past 15 years, Dan has been dishing and discussing on SoapCentral.com. And now he's taking the talk to the airwaves of the Voice America Variety Channel. You'll go behind the scenes with the biggest stars of daytime, along with guest commentary from the Soap Central columnists. and we'll take your questions and comments during our live show, Soap Central Live, every Friday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, 3 p.m. Pacific, on Voice America Variety.
You are tuned in to Bread for the Journey, Ordinary People Doing Extraordinary Deeds, with your host, Mariana Cacciatore. If you have a question or comment about the program, or have an idea for a person you would like featured on a future program, please send an email to bfjradio@gmail.com. That's bfjradio@gmail.com. And now, back to Bread for the Journey.
Welcome back, and we're here talking with Dr. Margaret Blaustein about kids who are in trauma, how to be with them, what caregivers need to know to be with them in a way that is helpful and welcomed. So there's a word. Caregiver has an affect, the child has an affect, and then there is a dynamic that's occurring between the two. What I'd like to know is if you can tell our audience, what is affect and what's the dynamic that occurs between child and caregiver?
Sure. So, you know, it's interesting because we've talked a lot about emotions. You know, I'm a psychologist. I'm a clinical psychologist. I work with kids. I work with families. And we spend an awful lot of time talking about feelings and, you know, what we feel and what the different emotions are. And we think about feelings, but we also think more broadly just about the sort of physiological arousal in our body. So we all have a range of emotions that happen all day long. We react to things. We react to what's happening inside of us. We react to what's happening outside of us. All of that can generate different feelings. But we also all have different body states that we're in. So whether we have high energy or low energy, whether we feel comfortable or uncomfortable in our bodies, revved up or shut down or frozen, and we kind of incorporate all of that in our thinking. So we're really thinking about the range of internal experiences that someone has on many levels, how comfortable or uncomfortable it is in the body, how intense it is, and how in control we are of it.
Okay. I'm not sure I really understand yet what affect is.
Sure. I mean, at its most basic, think of, you know, I think people, we use the word affect often just to talk about emotions. Okay. But then add on to emotional experience, the energy of that experience. So someone, for instance, let me get concrete, can be mad. There's nothing wrong with being mad. We're all mad sometimes. We talk about feelings are really important. They give us good information. I never have as a goal getting rid of kids' feelings because if I'm mad, it tells me something's happening that I don't like. And if I'm sad, it tells me that I might need some support around something. You know, if I'm excited, it tells me something good just happened. So emotions are valuable. There's nothing wrong with being mad. Depending how big the mad is, it can get harder and harder for me to deal with, depending how intense it is, and depending how in control I feel of it. So it's one thing for me to feel a little frustrated or feel mad. It's another for that feeling to last all day and to not be able to get rid of it. It's another for it to be at an intensity of 10 instead of an intensity of 2. And to be at that intensity and for me to not know how to manage or bring it down.
Got it. So that happens with adults and it happens with kids.
Absolutely. And all feel what we feel.
Right. And, I mean, we expect as adults, we've learned over time our own affect. Right. And yet sometimes we have blind spots and no matter what the situation is, you know, we could be at some person in an adult's life, whether it's the bus driver, whether it's the person who works at Head Start, or whether it's a foster parent who's got 3 other foster kids.
Uh-huh. You know,
our job is to pay attention to what's happening with that kid, pay attention to what's happening with us, and be aware of the dynamic that's happening between the two, and over time get better and better at it.
Ideally. I think, you know, I love it when people think about that as part of the job. Of course, that's not always what happens, right? People think of my job, for instance, as a teacher is to educate a child, and of course it is. But the child's going to have a much better academic outcome if they're in a regulated classroom, right? Or my job as a parent is to make sure my child is safe and taken care of and learn some values. But how does that happen, and what kind of a way does it happen that feels not just comfortable but joyous and rewarding for both the child and the parent?
Right. So one of the ways in which a caregiver, the ways which a caregiver can be really helpful to a child is to take good care of themselves.
Absolutely. You know, the thing they say on planes is, in case of emergency, you put on your oxygen mask first.
Right. So I think first, I mean, I think about all the self-care things I've had to do over the course of my lifetime, and a lot of them for me have actually originated with feeling as though I could deserve to have whatever it was I needed. Do you find that to be true as well with people that you're working with? Like, actually, the first step saying, I deserve whatever it is, a time out for myself. I'm giving kids a time out.
It's interesting. I think that we hear a lot of different things from adults around that, including, you know, I think even more common is I don't have time. And I have time, you know, to take care of my child, but I don't have time to stop and think about myself and to go take a break and take a relaxation, take 30 minutes out of my day to do something for me. I don't have that kind of a time. And yes, I think feeling like you deserve it, that it matters, is another piece of that. And, you know, I sort of sometimes want to turn it around and say, well, what are you trying to do here, right? What's your goal? And your goal is to support your child and keep a safe home and all of these other things. How much better does that work when you do take care of yourself versus when you don't? And there's reality. I, you know, as I said, I'm a parent. I have two young children, and self-care looks really different now than it did a few years ago. And it's one of the things that we really like to pay attention to with caregivers, again, whether it's parents or teachers or whoever, is what are the realistic constraints? And that's why we don't just emphasize, you know, specific skill sets like, you know, deep breathing. And I'm a big fan of deep breathing, but we don't just say, everyone go do X, because X isn't going to work in every situation for every person at every time. We say, let's think about when you're going to need it and what's realistic. Right. What's the real world thing you can do? Can you take, I call them 5-minute vacations. A 5-minute vacation is when you say, for the next 5 minutes, I'm not going to think about anything that came before. I'm not going to, you know, think about my to-do list. I'm going to take 5 minutes. I'm going to close the bathroom door. I'm going to, whatever it is you're going to do in that 5 minutes that you're going to build in. And to think of things like that, that fit within the realistic constraints of the role that you have and the situation that you're in.
And really find things that are helpful and useful. You know, when I said the piece about deserving, and you were talking about, you know, oftentimes the first thing that shows up is, the objection is, I don't have time. Uh-huh. That was really true for me, too. I don't have time to do that. I'm a really busy person. But then when I peeled away the layer of that, underneath that, for me, really was, I didn't think I deserved it. I really had to work with that deserving piece and really had to work with loving myself enough to take the time to not let that objection be a real objection.
Right. And to hold that it matters, for who you are and for how you get through your days.
Right. And it's a very different, you know, I've been doing this for many years. It's very different picture today, just as you said, you know, changes what your self-care strategies are today, very different than they were even 2 years ago. Your kids grow up, you know, everything changes, right?
Right. Yeah. Always. And so all of these things, and this is one of the things we also talk to people about, all these skills we talk about, they're dynamic. It's not that you learn a concept, you figure out one strategy, and then that's going to work for the rest of your life.
Right.
Because things change, and you change, and kids change, and the system you're in changes. So hold the concept rather than the technique. And we talk about that a lot with our framework, which is a concept-driven as opposed to technique-driven framework.
What I have found, I will say, over time has been breathing. That's been one of the things that has been universal since I began doing meditation in my 20s. No matter what situation I find myself in where I'm feeling a little bit aroused, whatever it is, if I can take a moment and just do some breathing, always brings me back to kind of a clear head. It's like a, you know, it's like a wind that goes through the body. That sort of
Well, breathing's the quickest single way to change your physiology. You know, so it works. I laugh. I sometimes have kids say to me, it doesn't work to breathe. And I say, well, it actually kind of does. It kind of does. So do it anyway, but we'll have to find something else that you feel like works for you. And that, I think, it highlights another thing, which is that we have to do things, but then we also have to be aware that we're doing them, which brings me back to that place of reflection and curiosity that so many people do the right things instinctively, but they're not aware of why the choices they're making are actually working. And part of what we're really trying to support people in is just getting more aware, more conscious that you're doing a lot of good stuff already. Can you pay attention to that?
Mm-hmm.
So that you can
there's
be more
a word that you used in some of the things I was reading, which was attunement. And when I think about attunement, I think about part of it is that I need to be attuned to myself.
Mm-hmm.
And then if I'm working with a child, my next step, or in any relationship, my next step then is to be attuned to what's going on in the relationship. And then, of course, to be curious about whether or not my assumptions are right. Yes?
Absolutely, yes. And in some ways, we think of it as sort of this trickle-down thing where it starts with ourselves, of paying attention, being attuned to our own experience and managing it, in turn tuning into and supporting the experience of the child. And over time, the hope is that what that does, and this is really what, again, happens in normative development, which is a lot of what we're really trying to support and create in the systems in which children exist, is that lays the groundwork for children being increasingly able to tune into themselves.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense. And I imagine that it's even more challenging for people like step-parents or foster parents or adoptive parents because, you know, they're starting from a different place. They haven't known the child since birth. Step-parents don't have the same kind of power in the relationship as a birth parent does.
There's so many complicated relationships in this world, right? There's so many ways we enter into relationship. Part of it is that we all enter into relationships with our own set of assumptions and frames and lenses, and so we interpret what we see through our lens of the world. And, yeah, it's challenging to start new relationships for many reasons on many levels, some of which are about history and some of which are about the dynamics of that specific relationship. Having said that, people can certainly form wonderful, supportive, strong, loving relationships, you know, entering in really late in the game, as you know, in all sorts of situations. But, yeah, it can be challenging. It can be challenging for sure.
You know, I'm reminded of, we're getting close to the end of our interview, but there's three little words I have on a post-it note on the frame of my computer, which are communication, curiosity, and kindness. And just over the years, what I have found is that curiosity, you've already spoken about this.
Yeah.
Curiosity is really been the one most valuable tool. If I can, I mean, it's important for me to step into my knowing in situations, but it's also just as important and sometimes more important for me to not make the assumption that I know and to be curious about what's going on in a situation. And then secondly, the better I get at being able to find the right words to communicate what's going on for me, if I have to journal right or talk to a trusted friend until I get clear and then find the right words to communicate whatever it is that I'm needing to communicate, the better I get at that, the happier I am.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, the umbrella over the whole thing is kindness.
Right.
Like, to really remember that we're all sharing space on this planet, and that our real work is to be, you know, as kind as we can to each other, which doesn't always mean, you know, not setting boundaries. I mean, you know, it's kindness is kindness to everybody. But when we hold life within that framework, when I hold life within that framework, I'm happier and my relationships are better.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I really like your choice of three words. I mean, as you said, curiosity to me is really in many ways the heart of trauma work, because trauma is all about reaction. It's about needing to act suddenly, reactively, impulsively in the moment. And in some ways, while it can be very powerful, it's also the opposite of power, because what you're reacting to has the power. And so we really try to cultivate that curiosity. And it's interesting to think about how kindness drives curiosity and how curiosity drives kindness. A phrase that we use a lot is presume good intent, that we presume that people are doing the best they can with the resources that they have at any given point in time. And when I hold that, part of what curiosity can help me do is step back and say, you know, why does it make sense that for this person, this is how they have to manage their world? Doesn't mean I agree with it, that I necessarily accept it, that I don't protect myself when I need to or set the limits I need to, but I'm going to presume good intent.
That's beautiful. And I think it's a great way to end this interview. I want to thank you so much. This has been really fun for me.
Well, thank you for having me today. It was a pleasure to have a chance to talk with you about what we do and all the great work that people out there are doing.
Thank you so much. To our listening audience, Bread for the Journey is a nonprofit organization that could use your support. If you find a place in your heart to make a financial contribution, or if you'd like to start a chapter of Bread for the Journey in your town, please go to our website at breadforthejourney.org. If we all pitch in a little bit, we can change the world. And I close today, as I do every show, with this. May all beings be happy. May all beings be safe. May all beings be free.
We hope our program inspired you this week. Please join Mariana Cacciatore for another edition of Bread for the Journey next Saturday at noon Eastern Time, 9 a.m. Pacific Time on the Voice America Variety Channel. Enjoy the rest of your weekend.
Thanks again for listening to the preceding program, brought to you on the Voice America Variety Channel. For more information about our network and to check out additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericavariety.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the preceding program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.